The Wondersmith by Fitz James O'Brien. Part 5. Tied Up. Herr Hippa stood in the doorway, scowling. His eyes seemed to scorch the poor hunchback, whose form, physically inferior, crouched before that baneful, blazing glance, while his head, mentally brave, reared itself as if to redeem the cowardice of the frame to which it belonged. So the attitude of the serpent, the body pliant, yielding, supple, but the crest thrown aloft, erect and threatening. As for Zonela, she was frozen in the attitude of motion, a dancing nymph in colored marble, agility stunned, elasticity petrified. Furbelow, astonished at this sudden change, and catching with all the mysterious rapidity of instinct peculiar to the lower animals, at the enigmatical character of the situation, turned his pleading, melancholy eyes from one to another of the motionless three, as if begging that his humble intellect, pardon me, naturalists, for the use of this word intellect in the matter of a monkey, should be enlightened as speedily as possible. Not receiving the desired information, he, after the manner of trained animals, returned to his muttons. In other words, he conceived that this unusual entrance and consequent dramatic tableau meant shop. He therefore dropped Zanella's hand and pattered on his velvety little feet over to the grim figure of the Wondersmith, holding out his poor little paw for the customary copper. He had but one idea drilled into him, soulless creature that he was, and that was alms. But I have seen creatures that profess to have souls, and that would have been indignant if you had denied them immortality, who took to the soliciting of alms as naturally as if beggary had been the original sin, and was regularly born with them, and never baptized out of them. I will give these bandits of the Order of Charity this credit, however, that they knew the best highways and the richest founts of benevolence, unlike to Furbelow, who, unreasoning and undiscriminating, begged from the first person that was near. Furbelow, owing to this intellectual inferiority to the before-mentioned Alsatians, frequently got more kicks than coppers, and the present supplication which he indulged in towards the Wondersmith was a terrible confirmation of the rule. The reply to the extended pleading paw was what might be called a double-barreled kick, a kick to be represented by the power of two when the foot touched the object, multiplied by four when the entire leg formed an angle of 45 degrees with the spinal column. The long, nervous leg of the Wondersmith caught the little creature in the center of the body, doubled up his brown, hairy form till he looked like a fur-driving glove, and sent him whizzing across the room into a far corner, where he dropped senseless and flaccid. This vengeance which Herr Hippa executed upon Furbelow seemed to have operated as a sort of escape valve, and he found voice. He hissed out the question, "Who are you?" to the hunchback, and in listening to that essence of sibilation, it really seemed as if it proceeded from the serpent that curled upon his upper lip. "Who are you, deformed dog? Who are you? What do you here?" "My name is Solon," answered the fearless head of the hunchback, while the frail, cowardly body shivered and trembled inch by inch into a corner. "So you come to visit my daughter in the night time when I am away," continued the Wondersmith, with a sneering tone that dropped from his snake-wreathed mouth like poison. "You are a brave and gallant lover, are you not? Where did you win that order of the curse of God that decorates your shoulders? The women turn their heads and look after you in the street when they pass, do they not? Lost in admiration of that symmetrical figure, those graceful limbs, that neck pliant as the stem that moors the lotus. Elegant, conquering Christian cripple, what do you hear in my daughter's room?" Can you imagine Jove, limitless in power and wrath, hurling from his vast grasp mountain after mountain upon the struggling Enceladus? and picture the Titan sinking, sinking deeper and deeper into the earth, crushed and dying, with nothing visible through the superincumbent masses of Pelion and Ossa, but a gigantic head and two flaming eyes that, despite the death which is creeping through each vein, still flash back defiance to the divine enemy? Well, Solon and Herr Hippa presented such a picture, seen through the wrong end of a telescope, reduced in proportion, but alike in action. Solon's feeble body seemed to sink into utter annihilation beneath the horrible taunts that his enemy hurled at him, while the large, brave brow and unconquered eyes still sent forth a magnetic resistance. Suddenly, the poor hunchback felt his arm grasped. A thrill seemed to run through his entire body. A warm atmosphere, invigorating and full of delicious odor, surrounded him. It appeared as if invisible bandages were twisted all about his limbs, giving him a strange strength. His sinking legs straightened. His powerless arms were braced. Astonished, he glanced round for an instant and beheld Zanella, with a world of love burning in her large, lambent eyes, wreathing her round white arms about his humped shoulders. Then the poet knew the great sustaining power of love. Solon reared himself boldly. "Sneer at my poor form," he cried in strong, vibrating tones, flinging out one long arm and one thin finger at the wondersmith, as if he would have impaled him like a beetle. "Humiliate me if you can. I care not. You are a wretch, and I am honest and pure. This girl is not your daughter. You are like one of those demons in the fairy tales that held beauty and purity locked in infernal spells. I do not fear you, Herr Hippa. There are stories abroad about you in the neighborhood, and when you pass, people say that they feel evil and blight hovering over their thresholds. You persecute this girl. You are her tyrant. You hate her. I am a cripple. Providence has cast this lump upon my shoulders. But that is nothing. The camel, that is the salvation of the children of the desert, has been given his hump in order that he might bear his human burden better. This girl, who is as homeless as the Arab, is my appointed load in life. And please God, I will carry her on this back, hunched though it may be. I have come to see her because I love her, because she loves me. You have no claim on her, so I will take her from you." Quick as lightning, the wondersmith had stridden a few paces and grasped the poor cripple, who was yet quivering with the departing thunder of his passion. He seized him in his bony, muscular grasp as he would have seized a puppet, and held him at arm's length, gasping and powerless, while Zanella, pale, breathless, entreating, sank half-kneeling on the floor. "Your skeleton will be interesting to science when you are dead, Mr. Solon," hissed the wondersmith. "But before I have the pleasure of reducing you to an anatomy, which I will assuredly do, I wish to compliment you on your power of penetration, or sources of information, for I know not if you have derived your knowledge from your own mental research or the efforts of others. You are perfectly correct in your statement that this charming young person, who day after day parades the streets with a barrel organ and a monkey, the last unhappily indisposed at present, listening to the degrading jokes of ribald boys and depraved men, you are quite correct, sir, in stating that she is not my daughter. On the contrary, she is the daughter of a Hungarian nobleman who had the misfortune to incur my displeasure. I had a son, crooked spawn of a Christian. A son, not like you, cankered, gnarled stump of life that you are, but a youth tall and fair and noble in aspect, as became a child of one whose lineage makes Pharaoh modern, a youth whose foot in the dance was as swift and beautiful to look at as the golden sandals of the sun when he dances upon the sea in summer. This youth was virtuous and good, and being of good race, and dwelling in a country where his rank, gypsy as he was recognized, he mixed with the proudest of the land. One day he fell in with this accursed Hungarian, a fierce drinker of that devil's blood called brandy. My child, until that hour, had avoided this bane of our race. Generous wine he drank, because the soul of the sun our ancestor palpitated in its purple waves. But brandy, which is fallen and accursed wine, as devils are fallen and accursed angels, had never crossed his lips, until in an evil hour he was reduced by this Christian hog. And from that day forth his life was one fiery debauch, which set only in the black waves of death. I vowed vengeance on the destroyer of my child, and I kept my word. I have destroyed his child, not compassed her death, but blighted her life, steeped her in misery and poverty. And now, thanks to the thousand devils, I have discovered a new torture for her heart. She thought to solace her life with a love episode. Sweet little epicure that she was. She shall have her little crooked lover, shan't she? Oh, yes, she shall have him, cold and stark and livid, with that great black heavy hunch which no back, however broad, can bear. Death sitting between his shoulders. There was something so awful and demoniac in this entire speech, and the manner in which it was delivered, that it petrified Zanella into a mere inanimate figure, whose eyes seemed unalterably fixed on the fierce, cruel face of the Wondersmith. As for Solon, he was paralyzed in the grasp of his foe. He heard but could not reply. His large eyes, dilated with horror to far beyond their ordinary size, expressed unutterable agony. The last sentence had hardly been hissed out by the gypsy when he took from his pocket a long, thin coil of whipcord, which he entangled in a complicated mesh around the cripple's body. It was not the ordinary binding of a prisoner. The slender lash passed and repassed in a thousand intricate folds over the powerless limbs of the poor humpback. When the operation was completed, he looked as if he had been sewed from head to foot in some singularly ingenious species of network. "Now, my pretty lopsided little lover," laughed Herr Hippe, flinging Solon over his shoulder as a fisherman might fling a net full of fish, "we will proceed to put you into your little cage until your little coffin is quite ready. Meanwhile, we will lock up your darling beggar girl to mourn over your untimely end." So saying, he stepped from the room with his captive and securely locked the door behind him. When he had disappeared, the frozen Zanella thawed, and with a shriek of anguish, flung herself on the inanimate body of Furbelow. End of part 5. Those graceful limbs, that neck pliant as the stem that moors the lotus.